Hello all, and welcome to today's online seminar hosted by the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE. My name is Dr. Fabrício Mendes Fialho, and I am a research officer at the LSE International Inequalities Institute, Politics of Inequality Research Team. I'm incredibly pleased to be chairing today's seminar titled Checkout and Debit, Global Capitalism, Economic Crisis, and Penal Politics in Greece, which is part of the III Inequality Seminar Series. Today's speaker is Dr. Leonidas Tsiolitis. Dr. Tsiolitis is an Associate Professor of Criminology and Deputy Head of Teaching in the Department of Social Policy. He's also Director of the LSE's Mannheim Center of Criminology, for Criminology. The main themes addressed in Leonidas' research can be grouped under two broad headings. First, the political economy and social psychology of punishment. And second, the implementation and consequences of penal and cognate policies. The focus of his work to date has been on the Mediterranean region and the Anglo-American world from both national and international comparative angles. As this event is in Zoom meeting rather than webinar format, we can see our audience and have a more interactive event. May I ask our audience to please keep yourselves muted, but videos on where possible. And as usual, there will be the chance for you to pose questions to the speakers following their presentation. Please do so by using the chat if you prefer, stating your name and affiliation in both cases. As a quick mention of upcoming events at the III, the next event in the Inequalities Seminar Series is titled, Does Dual Citizenship Reproduce Inequalities? And it will take place at 12:30 to 1:30 p.m. next Tuesday, 30th of November. Link to the event, along with more upcoming events, can be found in the chat. I will now hand over to Dr. Tsiolitis. Thank you all and enjoy the event.
Thank you very much, Fabrício. Let me first share my PowerPoint slides. Great. Okay, so thank you for these kind words of introduction, Fabrício, and also, of course, for the invitation to speak at this important seminar series. I should say outright that my presentation draws on a book project, some preliminary parts of which have already been published as articles in the European Journal of Criminology. Effectively, this is a project that situates the study of punishment in the context of insights produced by historical research, especially economic history. So let me start by offering some brief general observations on pertinent scholarship. Over the last two decades, scholarship has made significant advances in terms of charting and explaining the ways in which state punishment is influenced by economic and political forces. Most notably, we now understand a great deal more about the ways in which different economic systems and different political institutions relate to state punishment. I'm thinking here, for example, of the work produced by our LSE colleagues Nikki Lacey and David Soskis, amongst others, or indeed by scholars like the French sociologist Loïc Vacan. Further progress in this area, despite the significant advances that have been made so far, further progress in this area requires avoiding certain analytic tendencies that have to date been restrictive. I will only mention three such tendencies today. First, what we may term normalcy bias, in the sense that disproportionate attention has been paid typically to periods of relative political or economic stability. Second, Occidentalism, in the sense that the focus has been almost fixed on Anglophone, on the Western world, and even more so on Anglophone cases within the Western world. And third, methodological nationalism, given that developments inside nation states have commonly been investigated without consideration of the international, transnational, or global networks of which the nation states in question are part. As a result of this, our knowledge has remained limited about the effects that conditions of economic crisis have on state punishment, and about the role that incumbent governments' political orientation plays in this connection. Because of the fact that the few available studies on these questions have been preoccupied with the Anglo-American sphere, and only in the context of recent decades at that, we know even less either about the consequences that different types or experiences of economic crisis carry for state punishment, or about the influence exerted in this regard by government political orientations other than those that we typically find in long-established democracies, for example, Labour, Conservative, Democratic, Republican, Left, Right. Moreover, the impact that different extra-national actors and factors may have in terms of economic, political, or directly penal matters domestically is still poorly understood. So with a view to helping fill these gaps in the literature, this paper and the broader project explores the effects on state punishment that economic crisis and government political orientation have had in interaction with one another in the context of two economic crises in Greece. The first crisis was experienced in the late 1920s and early 1930s, and the second one in the 2010s. For reasons of time, my main but not exclusive focus will be on carceral policies and practices. Now, why have I chosen to focus on those two particular crises? In the Greek context, both crises were first fiscal crises. The Greek state was unable to bridge the deficit between its expenditures on the one hand and its tax revenues on the other hand. And in both cases, the fiscal crisis was followed by a severe debt crisis, as well as the government's demand for financial support from abroad. And both crises also coincided with a significant rupture in terms of the political orientation of government, as I will explain in a second. I should say, however, at this juncture, that the economic history of modern Greece, and indeed the history of modern Greece as a whole, is inextricably linked to repeated episodes of extensive borrowing from abroad. Before even gaining independence from the Ottoman Empire in 1829, Greece began assuming heavy financial debts to Western lenders. In considerable part, Greece's very success in the War of Independence was achieved thanks to two hefty loans which the insurgent Greeks contracted in the city of London in the mid-1820s in order to fund their then ongoing military operations. However, in effect, the struggle for geographical and political liberation from the Turks set Greece on a path of accumulating ever-growing debt to other foreign actors. This was largely because of the exploitative nature of international lending in itself, combined with Greece's own peripherality, economically speaking, which not only led the country to foreign creditors in the first instance, but it also served to raise the country's vulnerability to exploitation at the hands of creditors. New loans to Greece typically came at excessively high nominal interest rates, whose real value was further inflated due to speculative investing in Greek government bonds on international financial markets. Also, those loans came with vast fees and exorbitant commission expenses attached to them. What this practically meant was that the net proceeds were at most sufficient to service previously accrued debts, which in its turn meant that Greece repeatedly needed to raise new external loans and accept creditors' demands for severe austerity measures if the country were to stay afloat. Ultimately, with limited, if any, funds left to support economic development, the country was locked in a subordinate status, both in terms of her ongoing and deepening financial dependence on foreign actors, but also in terms of the erosion that her political sovereignty suffered as a result of their meddling in her domestic affairs. Now, with regard specifically to the Great Recession of the late 1920s, this is a period that saw the Greek economy undergo a severe crisis whose main roots can be clearly traced abroad and to the global capitalist system in particular, both in terms of the exogenous shocks that either triggered or intensified the crisis, and in terms of the circumstances that enhanced the Greek economy's vulnerability to those shocks. In the interwar era, Greece contracted several external loans, the size and exploitative conditions of which posed a most severe hindrance to the country's economic recovery. Even worse, high and growing indebtedness also increased Greece's sensitivity to exogenous shocks. This sensitivity came into sharp relief towards the end of the 1920s and at the beginning of the 1930s, when three such shocks occurred either simultaneously or in close proximity to one another. The first one was the repeated emergence of extreme weather conditions between 1928 and 1930, as a result of which Greece's agricultural production was badly diminished. The second was, of course, the Wall Street crash of 1929, which caused the collapse of global commodity markets. And the third one was Britain's exit from the gold standard, a Brexit, if you want, which essentially intensified the effects of the 1929 crash. Each of those three shocks, which would have alone sufficed to cause harsh reverberations to the debt-ridden Greek economy. Cumulatively, of course, their effect was bound to be tragic. By 1932, Greece's external debt was by far the highest amongst debtor countries around the world. Due ironically to the fact that Greece failed to secure yet another loan from abroad, the country defaulted on her external debt. Now, of course, Greece was certainly not the only debtor country to default during this period. Nevertheless, as economic historians Barry Eichengreen and Richard Portes have shown, the level of debt that Greece had at the time rendered the country an exceptionally heavy defaulter by international comparison. This period of time, the span between 1928 and 1932, also signified an important shift in government political orientation in Greece. This was the first time in nearly 10 years during which the country had been ruled by military coups, pro-royalist conservatives, splintered liberals, or cross-party coalitions, that a largely united liberal party returned to power as a single-party government, and indeed with a strong majority. This was in fact the sole occasion in the interwar era that an elected government in Greece managed to serve out its full four-year parliamentary term. The Liberal Party had a comprehensive program of modernization of state economy and society. And crucially, part of this plan was the transformation of the Greek state from an entity that tried to sustain order primarily through law enforcement into an entity which would govern society mainly through welfare provision, namely through welfare services that were meant to mitigate social problems, which were themselves linked to extant economic arrangements, and which might otherwise give rise to challenges to the political and economic status quo. Moreover, when back in the 1910s, the Liberal Party had again been in government under the same leadership, under the leadership of Eleftherios Venizelos, who was also the founder of the party, back in the 1910s, the Liberal Party had undertaken efforts to promote progressive reforms on the penal front, ranging, amongst others, from the legislation of measures meant to reduce the use of imprisonment, to the passage of laws that enhanced prison oversight, to the development of detailed plans for the improvement of custodial conditions. What all this means is that the years 1928 to 1932 allow for investigating in relatively sufficient length of time how a government's welfarist outlook interacted with a grave economic crisis whose own origins primarily lay outside Greece's own borders to influence penal policy. Now, what about the crisis that took place in Greece in the 2010s? Contemporary Greece readily lends itself as a case study through which to advance understanding of how penal policies and practices relate to the political orientation of incumbent parties and the experience and fiscal ramifications of national economic downturn. The electoral victory of left-wing party Syriza and the formation of a coalition government under its leadership in January 2015 not only signaled an end to the dominance of, the two centrist political parties, PASOK on the center-left and New Democracy on the center-right, that had ruled Greece since the restoration of democracy in the country in 1974, it also opened up the possibility of a drastic change of course, specifically in terms of the use of punishment in the country. Why? This was because Syriza was known for its exceptionally high sensitivity to all matters carceral and the resolution that the party had to promote large-scale progressive reforms of penal and cognate policies, alongside, of course, the party's broader commitment to drastically change Greek politics and society as a whole. But the juncture at which the Syriza-led government assumed duties was also a tipping point for the Greek economy. Economic upheaval began in Greece with the 2008 downturn, which affected, of course, as we know, many countries internationally. At least within the European Union, however, no other state experienced so deep or prolonged a crisis as Greece. By the time that a Syriza-led coalition government was formed in January 2015, the Greek economy was getting closer and closer to collapse. In an effort to manage the inordinate size of Greece's sovereign debt and to overcome the country's consequent inability to access bond markets, previous governments had already received two bailout packages from the so-called Troika, the European Commission, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank. The first bailout package had been received in 2010, the second one had been received in 2012. Each of those packages had come, on the one hand, with a broad range of strict conditions, such as austerity measures, the further deregulation of the labor market, the sale of valuable assets, public assets, and in-depth administrative reforms. And also, on the other hand, with the heavy involvement of creditors in domestic policy making, more generally, and their close oversight of the implementation of the measures that they were imposing. When Syriza assumed power, the country was in the midst of an incomparably extended period of deep economic recession. The implementation of the second bailout package that the previous government had agreed had stalled, and the prospect of bankruptcy and exit from the Eurozone, the so-called Grexit, was looming over the horizon. The years of Syriza in government, therefore, allow also for assessing how a government's progressive outlook interacted with a grave economic crisis, which once again largely originated from the international sphere to influence penal policy. Now, let's go back to the 1920s and 1930s. What happened to punishment during that period of time? What happened to penal policy? We cannot begin to answer this question unless we first look at key socioeconomic trends. Unemployment already stood at high levels in Greece before the global economic crisis hit, with one third of the potential labor force being jobless in 1929. At that point in time, and for the next 3 years, however, unemployment went into a rapid and sharp further rise. In the face of drastically reduced demand, whether in terms of exports or domestic consumption, large numbers of farmers were pushed into joblessness, just as more and more small enterprises were forced to downsize or shut down entirely. Unsurprisingly, real income also underwent a steep drop during this period of time. Now, to make things even worse, deterioration in personal finances made staying afloat increasingly challenging and more often than not outright impossible. The predicament was widespread in the agricultural sector, with swathes of refugees and native peasants having accumulated debts to local banks in order to be able to satisfy pressing living needs. Just to give you a flavor of this, in 1930, the approximate number of farmers with a short-term debt to the then nascent Agricultural Bank of Greece was as high as 286,000, whilst an estimated 58,000 farmers owed the bank a secure debt, in other words, a debt backed by collaterals. By 1932, the overall total of farmers' debts amounted to a colossal 8.5 billion drachmas. And the situation was not dissimilar in industry. As big capital had been making vast profits, many owners of small units had been amassing heavy debts to banks in order to make ends meet. Against this background, starvation also began to spread amongst the lower strata in various parts of the country, both in urban areas, but of course also in rural areas. And all this combined with wretched housing conditions and associated epidemics to intensify discontent amongst the masses. Against this background, the appeal of resort to radicalism was increased. Workers' protest actions began gradually to grow in terms of their frequency, the number of participants, and the array of sectors who were involved in protest actions, but also in terms of their assertiveness. And here I'm relying on the groundbreaking work of Serafim Seferiadis, who is an expert on this particular aspect of Greece's history. Marches, rallies, strikes, and riots spread, especially in cities, but also increasingly in the countryside, with protesters usually demanding debt freezes, cheaper credit, and lower taxes. By 1932, labor mobilizations had risen to a level that the country had not experienced in the interwar era until that point in time. Now, the immediate question is, how did the liberal government, which, remember, aspired to govern through welfare provision, not through law enforcement so much, react? Partly in an effort to anticipate labor unrest and partly in reaction to the rise of labor unrest, the government deployed the pretext of fighting what was described as the foreign danger of communist subversion. Under this pretext, the government reorganized and expanded the security apparatus of the state, and it also introduced the infamous Idionim law, the so-called Idionimon, which lent the state far-reaching powers to crack down on any form of protest. Even reading a communist newspaper at the time became effectively a criminal offense. Ultimately, these developments allowed for the intensified use of intimidatory and repressive measures against mobilized workers, whether in terms of protest policing or in terms of political imprisonment and exile. Regardless of whether labor mobilizations were organized by communists or not, they became ever more likely to be met with violence by the coercive apparatus of the state. In fact, in one of the photos that I have on the slides, you can see a primitive water cannon. By 1931, nearly half of labor mobilizations were subjected to physical coercion by the police, the gendarmes, or the army. Dynamic dispersals and arrests were particularly common, but clashes with the authorities increasingly also resulted in protesters getting injured and even killed. With a view to preventing labor mobilizations from occurring in the first instance, there was also an intensification of raids upon trade union buildings, both by state forces, but also by fascist paramilitaries who were effectively sanctioned by the liberal government itself. Similarly, the application of the Idionimon, the Idionim law, escalated exponentially, with hundreds being sent to prison and exile. A total of 1,533 custodial sentences were passed between 1929 and 1932 for violations of the Idionimon. Moreover, the number of custodial sentences that were passed for such violations underwent year-on-year increases during this period of time, increasing by a colossal 666% overall during this period. The custody terms that were set by courts were mostly up to a year, although longer sentences became increasingly common with time. Belligerent action against the labor movement was at its most pronounced in large cities, which also helps to explain the disproportionate representation of industrial workers amongst the targeted population. Alongside those developments, a steep rise also occurred in the volume of people serving sentences, custodial sentences, for relatively minor criminal offenses. To give you only a flavor of this, between 1929 and 1932, the annual caseload of prisoners rose by half. In 1932, the caseload of prisoners was 70,000, which translated into a staggering 1,460 imprisonments per 100,000 members of population of imprisonable age. This is the highest rate ever to have been recorded in Greece's penal history. Notwithstanding, the crime control mission that the government formally ascribed to imprisonment for relatively minor criminal offenses, this kind of punishment was expanded by the government in an effort to further tighten the grip of the state over the impoverished working classes in the sense of cowing them into submission to the established politico-economic order. At the same time, but I will not go into detail in relation to this, but I will mention it, there was a push also to accelerate the use of conversion of short prison sentences into hefty monetary penalties or fines in order to raise proceeds that would then help to reduce state budget gaps. When we consider all this information together, it becomes quite clear that the Liberal government did not only deviate from the Liberal Party's own vision of maintaining socio-political order through welfarist interventions, it also effectively reproduced and in fact redoubled the authoritarianism of past administrations, including dictatorial regimes. In so doing, moreover, it paved the way to even more repressive criminal justice and cognate policies that were adopted in subsequent years, most notably by the dictatorship of General Metaxas from 1936 onwards, and which ironically ended up including as targets members of the Liberal Party themselves. Now, moving on to the crisis of the 2010s. By the time that Syriza was on the verge of assuming office as the senior partner of a coalition in January 2015, the use of imprisonment, as you can see in the graph on the screen, on the slide, the use of imprisonment in Greece had undergone a long-term rise. In 2014, the caseload of convicted and remand prisoners stood at 20,000, or 184 per 100,000 members of population. This represented an increase of 120% over the previous three decades, although the rise was especially pronounced from 2000 onwards. The overall growth of the prisoner caseload had been reflective of a rise, specifically in the caseload of convicted prisoners, and particularly of those amongst them serving longer sentences. It is important, however, also to note here that it was foreigners, not Greeks, who bore the brunt in this regard. By 2014, the proportion of non-Greeks in the country's caseload of convicted prisoners had come to exceed that of Greeks themselves. There were more foreigners in Greek prisons than Greeks. Now, one of the first major pieces of legislation that the Syriza-led government brought to parliament was a bill whose central aims were first to abolish maximum security prisons as such, second, to promote drug rehabilitation treatment for prisoners in need, and third, to reduce the use of custodial punishment and relieve prison overcrowding through an array of measures, for example, through limiting the range of imprisonable offenses for young people, setting limits to the prolonged detention of foreigners facing deportation after the expiry of the custody term that had been set by courts, and also relaxing the eligibility criteria for early release, for parole, including for elderly and disabled prisoners. This bill was not exhaustive of the scope of prison reform that Syriza had been planning to bring about. Nevertheless, its passage and successful implementation were seen as vital to progressing with a series of further measures in due course, so as eventually to accomplish a major overhaul of the country's prison system as a whole. As one might expect, a bitter conflict immediately ensued, both in parliament and in the mass media. Syriza stood alone amongst elected parties, justifying the proposed bill by invoking humanitarian principles, but also pointing, remember in the context of a finance of an economic crisis, pointing to the monetary and symbolic implications that relevant European Court of Human Rights rulings carried for the country. The other parliamentary forces expressed a variety of disagreements, some of which were also echoed by powerful judicial circles, such as the Greek Union of Prosecutors. The most controversial aspects of the bill proved to be the scrapping of maximum security establishments and the provision that facilitated access to early release on health grounds. The former, the abolition of maximum security prisons, critics argued, indicated undue leniency towards hardened criminals and terrorists, whilst the whilst access to early release on health grounds would specifically allow, critics argued, Sabas Xiros, a prominent member of Greece's long-standing urban guerrilla group November 17, to be freed under house arrest. With memories still very much alive of American targets having been attacked on Greek soil by November 17, the US government also weighed in to push against the passage of the bill. For example, the then US Secretary of State, John Kerry, conveyed his country's concern in a phone call directly with Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. Also, to give just one of many examples one could give in this regard, on the morning of the very day that the bill was tabled in Parliament for a final vote, the US Ambassador to Athens, David Pearce, held a widely covered press conference about the matter, during which he condemned the early release provisions of the bill in general, and he also urged the Greek government to shut down any prospect of Xiros being paroled in particular. Indeed, in this press conference, effectively, David Pearce, the US ambassador to Athens, issued a thinly veiled threat to the Greeks that unless they followed the US demands on the penal front, they should really forget any possibility of the US supplying Greece with financial help at this crucial moment in Greece's economic history. Despite all this pressure on Greece, and with the junior coalition partners' support secured, the bill did pass as proposed. Despite appearances to the contrary, it is questionable, however, whether this bill delivered much by way of its intended decarcerative effects. At no point since the passage of the bill did total prisoner numbers cease being high. Throughout this period, for example, they were comparable to the numbers previously experienced when imprisonment was undergoing an explosive rise in the mid to late 2000s. Moreover, the fall in prisoner numbers that was achieved, around 10% overall by 2019, was anything but persistent or comprehensive. The reduction concerned specifically convicted prisoners, whilst the numbers of pretrial detainees significantly increased. Moreover, the reduction was effectively achieved in the first 2 years of Syriza in government. From 2018 onwards, prison rates resumed their usual upward trajectory. What is more, although the number of convicted prisoners underwent an overall decline as such, the share of prisoners serving long terms actually increased significantly. At the beginning of 2019, 9 out of every 10 prisoners were serving sentences of 5 years and above. Effectively, therefore, the Syriza-led coalition saw its prison reform bill being undermined by judicial practice, both in the sense that judges continued ordering pretrial detention at excessive rates, and also in the sense that they expanded their imposition of long-term custodial sentences. Those stubbornly high prisoner numbers, in combination with the fact that the rise in the operational capacity of the prison system was only negligible during the years under consideration, meant that prison overcrowding was bound to remain severe. Indeed, it was one of the highest by European comparison. There were some positive developments in certain prison establishments around the country, most notably the institution of a dedicated drug rehabilitation unit in a prison in northern Greece, the prison of Diabata. And there were also there was also the strengthening of cognate services in a select number of prisons elsewhere in the country. However, the overall situation inside prisons, in terms of prison conditions, did not cease being dire. It is impossible to understand why the Syriza-led government failed to make sufficient headway towards improving prison conditions without considering that it found itself severely restricted under the Troika's tutelage as to how much public funding it could utilize for prisons. So restricted, indeed, that the government was forced to underspend the already meager budget for prisons. Under the harsh terms of the loan agreement that had been reached in the summer of 2015, the Troika did not only afford the Syriza-led government no leeway over budget formulation, it was also able to quash the government's stated plans to increase public funding for a broad range of badly needed welfare-oriented measures. Although the Troika did include reforms to the justice system amongst the public management demands it made of Greece, those reforms were focused not on criminal justice, let alone on prisons, but rather on modernizing administrative and tax court procedures in order to support economic activity. On the other hand, the Syriza-led government was essentially pushed into a catch-22 situation, whereby intensification of ministerial budget underspending on a broad array of public investment fronts was the only readily available option it had for making a plausible appeal to the Troika for a desperately needed break from further austerity and at least some longed for debt relief. Although also linked to chronic bureaucratic inefficiencies, budget underspending on public investment was a key way in which Greece had previously managed to meet the stringent targets imposed by the Troika in terms of annual primary budget surpluses, which was itself a crucial prerequisite for the sustained inflow of vital tranches of bailout funds. In 2018, as the devastating effects of continuing austerity accumulated and spread across Greek society, but also with the next national election now approaching, the Syriza-led government doubled down on its under-execution of public expenditure in order to exceed what was by that point the highest Troika-mandated fiscal target of its tenure in office, that is, a primary budget surplus of 3.5% of GDP. Indeed, no other Greek government in the bailout era had underused public investment budgets to the extent that the Syriza-led coalition did that year. The rationale underlying this seemingly absurd move was that overachieving so high a fiscal target would help persuade the Troika that further austerity measures were no longer necessary, most notably in the form of scheduled pension cuts, and that debt relief was at last feasible in the Greek case. To this extent, persisting problems in terms of prison conditions were yet another form of collateral damage in the Syriza-led government's ongoing struggle against its international creditor for a stable and sustainable domestic economy, as well as for a halt to the further degradation in the living conditions of the average Greek person. All in all, then, the prison reform aspirations of the Syriza-led coalition government, or to be more precise, of Syriza as the senior partner of the coalition, were mostly crushed between the Scylla of judicial obstinacy and the Charybdis of external economic intervention. Throughout its stay in office, Syriza kept on trying to push through its reform agenda, albeit of necessity mainly by way of sporadic and small-scale measures that were beyond the grasp of either the judiciary or the Troika. For example, by repurposing existing resources to strengthen drug rehabilitation programs in certain prisons. Although the party, and by extension the government, in practice continued treating the Troika as an invincible force, they did advance and enforce limits to the obstructive discretionary powers of judges by passing an amendment to the country's penal code that reduced maximum sentence lengths. But this move, which was carried out as late as 2019, turned out to be no more than a parting shot. It was in fact the last major legislative action taken by the Syriza-led coalition on any policy front before the elections that brought it down in July that year. No sooner did right-of-center New Democracy return to power than it began undoing key legislative and other measures through which its predecessor, Syriza, effectively, had endeavored to reform the Greek prison system. So let me try to bring all this to a conclusion. I'm not sure how much more time I have. May I ask Fabrizio to clarify? Sorry, can you repeat this, please? Sorry.
17.
Okay, thank you. Right, so there are, of course, differences in the penal policies that were adopted by the Liberal government in the late 1920s and early 1930s, and by Syriza from the mid-2010s onwards. The Syriza-led government, for example, did not use punishment to suppress political opponents. It did not use punishment to suppress protest actions. Indeed, here I should say that despite all the problems that were facing Greek society during this period, I'm referring now to the mid-2010s onwards, protest actions with Syriza in government did undergo a decline as such. The Syriza-led government also promoted decarceration, although, as I was just explaining, with limited success. And there was also an effort, even if partial, on the part of the Syriza-led government to resist external intervention, at least when the Americans tried to oppose the prison reform bill that I discussed earlier. Nevertheless, there are two main conclusions to which both cases point to. The first is that economic downturn can place crucial limits on a government's ability to execute progressive plans in carceral penal matters. And the second conclusion is that a government's scope of action in this vein may be further restricted depending on the autonomy it can yield in defiance not only of domestic opposition, but also, and this in the Greek case is especially important, opposition of foreign forces intervening in both economic and political realms. To put this point differently, just as foreign forces may combine with economic crisis, but also with domestic opposition, to undermine a government's agenda for progressive reform to carceral policy and practice, the degree to which they might successfully do so is contingent upon the relative politico-economic strength of the state that the government in question represents in the international sphere. Thank you for your attention. I will stop here and I will look forward to your questions.
Dr. Chidiotis, thank you so much for your insightful presentation. I will now open the floor to questions from the audience. Please use the raise hand function to pose your questions or paste your question into the chat, stating your name and affiliation where possible. I will use my prerogative as chair to ask you for a historical parallel. You mentioned in your presentation that in the 1920s and 1930s, the liberal government in Greece basically used incarceration as a form of political suppression. And for me, it's impossible not to draw parallels to the so-called New Jim Crow in the United States, a country where imprisonment may mean disenfranchisement, and this has heavily affected the African-American population. And it's also there's also parallels to the overused term penal populism in countries like, for instance, the Philippines. So how do you, in this two phenomena, the Greek liberal government in the 1920s and the current New Jim Crow and penal populism, there is one century almost separating these two waves of use of imprisonment as a manner of political suppression. How do you establish parallels between these two movements or these two periods?
Thank you, Fabricio. If I may start by addressing that part of your question, which refers to penal populism. Penal populism is a concept that has been heavily used so far in pertinent literature. As it was originally devised, it effectively describes a situation, and I think it's important to clarify what it means before answering further. It effectively describes a situation whereby political actors exploit issues of crime and punishment in terms of the political discourse that they publicly employ with a view to advancing their own electoral interests. They try to manipulate public opinion, right? That's important to clarify. To this extent, I would say that penal populism is a term that could be used to describe more what the liberal government did in the late 1920s and early 1930s, insofar, for example, as they used the pretext of communist subversion in order to legitimate, retrospectively legitimate, belligerent, aggressive action against the labor movement. This is certainly not what the Syriza government tried to do in the second half of the 2010s. As I was explaining, in fact, the Syriza government tried, even if effectively, mostly unsuccessfully, to promote decarceration and more generally to bring a liberalization, to bring about a liberalization of the criminal justice system. Now, with regard to broader international comparisons one can draw between either of those two crises, I think that's a very important question. And I'm afraid that I will give you some somewhat vague answers. The reason for this being that, curiously, there isn't much systematic research on this, not even with regard to specific jurisdictions, let alone from international comparative perspectives. There is some research on the effects of the Great Depression on punishment. So there is some research that has shown that the Depression only had a weak positive effect on imprisonment rates in the United States. I'm referring here to research by criminologists Michalowski and Carlson. With regard to England and Wales, Stephen Box, another criminologist, found a null effect, no effect at all, either positive or negative. Whereas French criminologists have shown that there was a definite positive effect, in other words, in France, in other words, that during the years of the Great Depression, imprisonment, which is the main indicator used in such studies, underwent a significant increase. The same thing has been found in relation to Poland. The problem with this kind of research and the problem with trying to draw some comparative conclusions on the basis of this nation-state focused research is, amongst others, that they do not necessarily explain in sufficient depth how the Great Depression manifested itself macroeconomically. So it's difficult for us, or indeed how it was experienced by the average citizens, the average person. So it's difficult for us to draw reliable conclusions on the basis of this research. We need more systematic research. I hope this goes some way towards addressing your question.
Thank you, Dr. Chiliotis. Armin raised her hand. Please unmute yourself and ask your question.
Thanks, Fabrizio. Thank you, Leonidas, for this great presentation. Sorry, my voice is a little bit croaky. There's two things I was wondering. You know, one is, what has happened since Syriza left office? So if you could just talk a little bit more about that. And second, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking of Loikwa Kwon's work on the penalization of poverty and, you know, as a kind of penal measures being used in order to deal with, you know, growing poverty and social insecurity. Could you reflect on that a little bit in terms of this case? So I'm not going to talk anymore. Thank you.
Thank you, Armini. These are very helpful questions. So yes, what has happened since Syriza left power? So I only briefly mentioned that almost immediately after Syriza left power and New Democracy returned to power, New Democracy started with a very strong majority, started undoing many of the penal reforms that Syriza had struggled to bring about. So legislation has passed since, which has made it more difficult for prisoners to be released on furloughs, on home leave or work release. More importantly, it has legislation has passed which has restricted the eligibility criteria for release on parole, for early release, in other words. Furthermore, so-called agricultural prisoners perform agricultural tasks in semi-free conditions with a view to easing their transition back to free society towards the end of their release. Such prisons are also now much less in use. But also, there is a strong anti-migrant rhetoric that the current government has adopted, which has, of course, sent the symbolic message to the criminal justice system and its practitioners, especially the judges, that effectively the situation is as it used to be before Syriza was in power. That is important insofar as the numbers of foreigners who find themselves behind bars in Greece has, of course, remained very high. Your question allows me also to raise very briefly a further point, which is that in my presentation, I primarily focused, especially in relation to the Syriza era, on imprisonment trends in the country. The broader project also, however, looks at state punishment, state punitiveness, in a much broader sense, including, amongst other indicators of state punitiveness, the use of immigration detention, the administrative detention of irregular migrants, which effectively, despite formal descriptions that suggest otherwise, increasingly resembles conventional imprisonment. And this I mention partly because it is yet again, because it goes to show that it's important to take into account the anti-migrant rhetoric that has been systematically employed by the current government. Now, with regard to Loïc Vacan's work, Yes, I mean, Loic's point is that punishment is used in order to deal with the insecurities that neoliberalization of the economy brings about. So in this broad sense, of course, one can easily draw parallels between the points I raised with regard to the Syriza era and and his work. Nevertheless, in previous work that I have conducted with my colleague Safo Xenakis from Birkbeck, we have put to the test, as it were, not as it were, we have actually put to the test Loic Vacant's work, and we have concluded that what he refers to as neoliberalization of the economy is something that has occurred in Greece without necessarily formally neoliberal policies. In other words, the deregulation of the economy that Vacant includes as one of the formal criteria on the basis of which to conclude whether or not a certain economic system is increasingly or otherwise neoliberalized, that was happening in Greece well before the 2010s, right? So on the surface, I guess that's my answer. On the surface, it appears as though Vacant's argument has perfect application in the Greek case. However, when you dig deeper, you see that punishment has long been used in Greece in order to deal with what Vacant describes as neoliberalism, but which in Greece has not necessarily been neoliberalism, as he at least describes it. I hope this makes sense.
Thanks, Leonidas. Fabrizio, can I ask a follow-up question if there's no one else? Thanks, Fabrizio. And Leonidas, I mean, could you also talk about, because, you know, there has been a trend growing across some Mediterranean countries, you know, where those humanitarian actors, particularly not the formal humanitarian actors, not the NGOs, but the solidarians, you know, the volunteers, international volunteers, are also facing charges and potentially imprisonment. Is this something that's, you know, that you see also, you know, taking place as perhaps part of this penal policy of the new government?
Yes, you know, you're absolutely right. And this is yet another development that goes to show a very different ideological orientation and corresponding practices on the part of the current government. Just the other day, it was widely reported that there was a trial ongoing in Athens of precisely three humanitarian actors, people who helped refugees, who saved them from the sea, and who were charged with espionage.
I know.
And were taken to court. Now, as it happens, the court decided that this kind of charge was beyond its own jurisdiction, so it didn't proceed with trying the case. But this is not to say that the charge is still not there. Anyway, the broader point is that, yes, this is yet another way in which the current government appears to have sought to reverse the penal approach that the Syriza-led coalition adopted indefinitely.
Thank you for the questions, Armin. So it's been a pleasure for me to chair today's event. Thank you very much to Dr. Chiliotis for presenting this seminar. And thank you all in the audience who joined us today. If you would like to hear more from the LSE International Inequalities Institute, please follow the link in the chat function to learn about the upcoming events and sign up for the fortnightly newsletter. Until we meet again virtually or otherwise, thank you and goodbye.